Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49%. Based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products. Because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Look out! It's only films to be buried with.
Hello, and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I am a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a footstool, pillow, and I love films. As Oscar Wilde once said, I am so clever that sometimes I don't understand a single word of what I'm saying, much like the plot to Inside Man. It was so clever, I still don't really understand how any of it worked. Every week, I invite a special guest over, I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. If you've never heard the show, check it out. Check out the back catalogue. I've got Ricky Gervais, I've got Jameela Jamil, I've got January Jones, I've got Patrick Bryce, I mean, I've got Jamie Dimitri, the list goes on. This week, my special guest is British National Treasure, co-creator of Peep Show, himself, Mr. Sam Bain. If you do enjoy the show and you want to support it and get more content, come and join me at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you'll get extra guest questions for episodes, you'll get videos, guest list tickets, recommendations, all sorts of stuff. This week, there is a 20 minutes extra with Sam that is frankly quite extraordinary, and it's sad not to put it in the main episode, but the Patreon's got to have something special, and they really do this week, so don't miss out on that. And remember, best of all, if you do become a Patreon member, not only do you get all the extra stuff, you don't have to hear this bit about becoming a Patreon member. This bit is cut out, as well as the ads and all of that. It's just pure, unencumbered film podcast chat. Give it a look over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Also, some crazy guy has made merchandise for this. You can have a look if you like. If you go to podcastmerch.co.uk/films to be buried with, you too can own hoodies, t-shirts, baby bibs, caps, anything you like with the phrase troubling boner worrying wide on it. And other things, but that's the one I'd choose. Have a look at it. So, here we go. Sam Bain is the co-creator and co-writer of Peep Show, which ran for so many years, and it's fucking incredible. And he has just written the new film Corporate Animals, which is out in a couple of weeks or even a week, so look out for it. And it is directed by friend of the podcast with the best laugh, Mr. Patrick Bryce. I'd always been a fan of Sam's for years, but we'd never met before, and he kindly invited me to his house in LA, and this conversation was the first time we ever spoke to each other. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. He was great. Also, side note, he brought up the film Joe vs. the Volcano, and at the time I'd spoken to him, no one had mentioned it before. But if you listen to all the podcasts, you'll notice that when I then met January Jones, she was obsessed with that film. So when I say, bloody hell, Joe vs. the Volcano, I haven't heard that for a while, what I mean is, not yet, because this happened before that one, because we're stuck in a time loop. Anyway, hope that all makes sense. That is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 63 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I am joined today by a hero of mine. He is a playwright, he is a TV writer, and he is a film writer, and he is partly responsible in 50% for the best British sitcom of the 2000s and on. Is it? I'd say so. Please welcome to the show, it's Sam Bain.
Hey, Brett, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. We've never met before.
We haven't.
You've kindly invited me to your place in LA. I will say this about Sam Bain. He's done it. You've done it. I mean, you've really done it. You've done it. It's like if Peep Show, having seen Peep Show, I'd have thought you're the sort of man who couldn't actually in the end do it, but you've done it. It's beautiful. You have a beautiful place. You live in LA and you seem content. Is this true?
Pretty much. You know, I'm a human being, so we're not, we're never completely happy. I'm sorry to break it to you.
Oh, this is, well, in a way, comforting. We've got.
But no, I'm happy in LA. It's working out so far.
And I don't know which order this episode will go out with, but I've recorded an episode with Patrick Bryce, who is the director of your last film,
yes,
Corporate Animals. And he told me that you only want to make films now. Is that true?
That is basically true. That's all I'm doing, yeah. It's kind of why I'm here.
Brilliant.
You know, because films in the UK are less easy to get made, you know, especially original comedy scripts is what I'm trying to write.
Yeah.
That's a hard one. You know, they don't make that many of them. They do make some, but the volume over here is so much greater. You have much better chance. So that's kind of one of the reasons I came here.
Did you always want to make films? Was TV sidetrack you?
Well, I wouldn't call it a sidetrack because I've had a very, very good time doing TV. But yeah, I was like a teenage film buff. I was the sort of 12-year-old cineast. And I've always loved cinema and loved Hollywood and all that. So yeah, I guess it has always been a dream.
And you're doing it.
I'm living my life. I'm doing what I can to pump content into the culture in the form of film.
Not enough people doing it. It's very hard. How many films have you done now?
Well, I just shot the second one.
Congratulations.
Just finished shooting that 2 weeks ago.
That's a different one from Corporate Animals. What is that one?
It's called The Stand-In with Drew Barrymore playing two different roles.
Wow.
You shot that in New York.
You direct it?
No, I haven't directed anything yet. Jamie Babbitt, female director. Who did Russian Doll?
Yeah.
Among many other great things. Girls, Silicon Valley, lots of movies. She's amazing.
Yeah. How was the shoot? Were you there for the whole thing?
I was there for the whole thing. It was pretty intense, shooting in Manhattan, night shoots, guerrilla shooting of Drew Barrymore on the subway at 5 a.m., Times Square at dawn. It was pretty exciting. Hopefully it's good. We'll see. We're editing it.
That's great. And can you tell me this from a writing point of view, writing a 28-minute sitcom versus an hour and a half, two-hour film, what have you learned?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a learning curve. They're sort of very similar and very different. I think the main thing, obviously, is structure and length of the film because you have to have a sustaining story over 90 minutes. And so with a sitcom, to generalise massively, you might start with the characters like we did with The Peep Show. You start with Mark and Jeremy and think, well, what could they do this week? Whereas with a film, I usually start with the story, like what's the three-act structure? What's the beginning, middle and end of this story? And then who would do this crazy shit might come second, who the characters are.
I asked you before we started, but I would like it on mic. You and Jesse Armstrong love each other.
There is a deep and abiding love. Yeah, and actually we're hopefully going to do something together very soon, a film we've been writing for a long time.
Have you missed working with someone writing? It's fucking hard to write on your own. I'm assuming you have been writing on your own these days.
Yeah. You're pointing at my computer. That's where I actually do it. Yes. Yeah. Over there.
Yeah.
I sit over there on my own all day.
Going mad.
If I found it that hard, I probably wouldn't do it. But writing with someone else is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And we had 20 amazing years and we haven't written anything together for 3.5, which is a long time when you've been writing together 20 years. So I'm really excited about this next thing we're doing quite soon, hopefully. Yeah, it's just very different. I think you can go a bit deeper on your own. Like the stuff we tend to write on our own is more comedy drama. If you've seen Succession, Jesse's amazing show, you'll know it's definitely not a sitcom. And similarly, the stuff I'm writing is not sitcom. So you have a different voice on your own, I think.
Because you're less embarrassed to go deep because you don't have to pitch it to someone before you do it.
There's something about sitcom where you're looking at multiple jokes per page, where having someone to bounce off is brilliant. And there's many, many writing partnerships in the UK and obviously writing rooms in the US that show how that works. And writing a feature is a bit different.
How many drafts of Corporate Animals did you have to do?
Well, I kind of always lose count.
All right.
But it was always at least 10, 15, like proper drafts.
Good man.
Patrick Bryce made me do it. I didn't want to. He's a very, very...
He's a monster, isn't he?
He's a monster. He's a tough cookie.
He made that very clear in his episode. Now, Sam, I forgot to tell you something.
What?
And it's quite bad that I didn't tell you this when I got here. And I don't even know how you're going to take it, but you seem... I think you'll be all right with it. I'm just going to say it. Fuck it. I'll just have to say it. I'll say it. You've died.
Shit.
You died.
That's not good.
It's not good. Okay, I'm sorry. How did you die?
I think I'll go for the method that Jesse and I talked about, where he poisons me while pretending he's helping me back to health.
So you have a phantom thread relationship with Jesse.
I think we might have put that in Peep Show, the last series, but I can't remember. I've forgotten all that. But yeah, that's, you know, he's kind of feeds me mercury in my chicken soup, pretending he's nursing me back to health.
Yeah.
And I slip away slowly in my bed.
Have you seen The Phantom Thread?
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Okay, so that's your relationship with Jesse. Codependent. As codependent.
I don't think he'd go for poisoned mushrooms in the omelette, but I think he'd go for like a poisoned soup or something, a bit easier to...
How long is it going to take?
Because you can make soup in a big batch and then you just ladle it out over weeks.
And you just think, oh, I'm getting tired. Yes. So tired, Jesse.
Have some more soup, Sam. It'll get you right back on your feet.
But Jesse, I'm too tired to eat.
I'll spoon into your mouth.
Are you sure?
Just sign this, signing over all your points to Peep Show to me and then drink some soup.
Hang on, you're saying I have to change all the credits of Peep Show, so it's just your name?
It's fine. It's fine, honestly. It's just a technicality. Yeah.
It's quite a moving death. Do you worry about death? Does it fill you with dread?
I'm not a fan.
No?
Put it that way.
Not
it feels like it's a bit much. It's a bit unjust.
Mm.
The idea of the world just rolling happily along without me doesn't seem right.
No, I don't think it will, don't worry. Yeah. Do you lay awake at night worried about it?
No, but I would say that it probably, because I lost my father quite young, which you can find out all about on Griefcast.
Yeah, which is a very moving episode worth listening to. If you want to hear the really moving, tragic backstory.
Just a quick plug for my other podcast.
Yeah, Griefcast.
I talk about my tragic bereavement.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Previously on Sam Bates, it's available on Griefcast.
Yeah, sorry for spoilers, but yes. Because of that, I think that, like a lot of people who maybe lose a parent young, it hits you quite early. And so I think probably without even being conscious of it, I was probably quite driven to kind of like make the most of the life that I had, not knowing how long that would be from quite a young age, probably.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you think there's an afterlife?
I used to. I kind of don't think there is anymore, which is a bit of a shame.
What changed?
Well, I used to be like quite a committed Buddhist, which won't surprise you because you went to see my play.
I went to see your play. I was going to bring that up in a bit. What was it called again? I'm so sorry.
The Retreat.
The Retreat, yes. And so you wrote this play that was all about trying to find meaning and anything in all of it.
Yeah.
It was the existential nightmare that we exist in.
Mm. That's not my pitch, but I'll take it.
It was about a man really, really trying to find some spiritual connection and going to a Buddhist retreat in a mountain. And
exactly.
Did you have that experience?
Yeah, I'd done retreats. I did like a 30-day one up a mountain in Spain, and I've done silent retreats.
How long a silent retreat have you done?
I did like a 10-day one.
Oof.
I think I was only silent for 7 of the 10. We kind of limbered up the first few days.
Oh, really?
Just sort of having very short conversations.
How did you find that?
Well, it kind of informed Peep Show because I did that just before we created Peep Show. And I think some of the voiceover stuff was a reaction to listening to my own voice in my head with no filter for a week.
Well, that's an amazing origin story for Peep Show.
Well, it's not the only origin, and I wouldn't certainly take credit for creating the show. It was very much a joint venture, but I'm sure conversations with Jesse about that experience probably fed into it.
But is it that thing that you were walking around this retreat looking at people going, you're a dickhead?
Well, no, it's like you literally, if you literally don't read, don't watch TV, don't talk for a week, you have to listen to your own thoughts, and it's quite humiliating because they're mostly total bullshit. And I had a feeling, which I think is correct, luckily, that was quite a universal thing.
Right.
Most people have stupid, endlessly stupid thoughts. So we thought, let's put it on television and see if we connect.
So you stopped doing all that. Did you get to a point where you're like, this isn't working?
It was kind of, I really went up the mountain and sort of had to come down again, figuratively speaking.
Was there a time when it did work?
Well, I would, look, meditation is great and I would recommend it to people who haven't tried it. And it definitely changed me for the better. Yeah, I probably got the most out of it, as it were.
How old were you when you were doing that stuff? This is before Peep Show.
I was writing Peep Show while I was living in a Buddhist centre in London.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you lived in the centre?
Yeah, I went for it.
Oh, wow, you fully.
You got to go for it, man.
Yeah, no, I'm impressed. But you I sort of want to know why you stopped. It's sort of making me, it's like, oh, so there's no answer. Meditation is good, I agree with that.
I was getting quite religious by mistake, and that wasn't really working out.
Right.
That's probably the best way I can put it.
And I have lots of questions about this, but I don't want to push you on it. So now your being is, you meditate, you work, you appreciate what you have, that's it.
That sounds about the size of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you were in this, what wasn't the afterlife to you that now it is not?
Oh, well, the Buddhist afterlife, how long have you got? I mean, you got the hell realms, you've got the hungry ghosts, you've got the god realms, you've got enlightenment, which isn't really afterlife, that's just like nirvana.
Right.
It's a complex web of states.
Have you seen Star Wars The Last Jedi?
Very much so.
Does Luke Skywalker meditate himself to death?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good, I understood.
I think he finds astral projection so tiring he dies. Okay. That was my interpretation of it.
Okay. He hasn't reached nirvana and exploded.
It's so exhausting to put himself in that 3D body of hallucination. He just has a big sleep with no body left.
Well, listen, Sam, this may come as a shock to you. I don't know if you're even going to be annoyed about it, but there is an afterlife.
Okay.
And there's a heaven. It's almost boring, isn't it? It's just a straightforward heaven. Everyone's really nice.
Very Judeo-Christian, this podcast.
Yeah, surprisingly so. But the bit they miss out in the Bible is all the stuff about films and how obsessed with films everyone is in heaven. Okay. But the rest of it is pretty much the same. And this is heaven. It's nice. Everything you want is there. Mm. Don't know what you're into, but it's all there. But they are obsessed with film. And all they want to know about is your life, but through film. So the first thing they ask you is, what is the first film that you remember seeing?
I remember seeing The Cat from Outer Space, the Tuikinam Odeon.
I've seen the VHS cover, I have not seen the film.
I have no memory of anything about it.
The Cat from
Outer Space? Other than the title. I think it was a Disney live-action movie.
Yes.
From the 70s.
That probably had Dean Jones or something in it.
Yeah, I've no nothing else to offer you apart from the title.
Tuikinam Odeon?
Yeah.
And
demolished, sadly. No longer. I saw Star Wars there as well.
How old were you?
Well, Star Wars, I would have been 6 when it came out.
How old for Cat from Outer Space?
Probably 5, I imagine, it's the previous year. I could check that, but I haven't bothered.
You don't need to. No one listening will care. Or maybe they do, I don't know. That's disrespectful to the listeners. If you care, I'm so sorry, but please Google it. The Cat from Outer Space. So do you remember going with someone?
My
mum. Your mum take you?
Yeah.
Sorry to go over this again. How old were you when your dad died?
10 and a half.
Okay, so it's just you and your mum. Do you have brothers and sisters?
You got a brother.
Close?
Yeah.
Okay. But he didn't come to Cat from Outer Space?
I don't think so. Anyway, I just remember feeling good about the whole experience.
Yeah.
Like it was like, yeah. That was my reaction. Yeah.
Yeah, this
yes,
is
please.
It.
Yes, please.
More cats from outer space, please. Okay, good one. I mean, you don't remember anything but the title. It's a good title.
It's a great title.
We should do the remake.
So that's probably better than the film. I don't really want to know the plot.
Yeah. Please no one tweet what the fucking plot of Cat from Outer Space is and ruin it.
I think I might be able to guess some of it. But
yeah, unless it's all metaphorical. And someone in the film, it's a love story, and someone in the film goes, you know what you are? You're like a cat from outer space.
Like a weird indie drama. Yeah, I don't think it's that. I think it was about a cat around. So I think they might have had a glowing collar and possibly could speak to humans. I'm just grabbing at straws at this point.
Definitely sounds right.
Definitely. And if it isn't right, we're making it. What is the film that scared you the most?
Again, as a young person, I was probably, I don't know how I managed to see it, yes, but The Omen, which obviously is a 70s classic.
Yeah.
That's a genuinely terrifying and very good film.
Yeah.
I think the bit which really stayed with me was the bit where, is it David Warner who gets his head chopped off by a flying
window
plane of glass?
Yeah.
I mean, you watch it again now and the head is quite a lot like a mannequin from Madame Tussauds, but at the time, that was quite a moment in a young man's life of sheer terror.
Yeah.
But also in my later years, I got terrified by the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, even though I was far too old to really be scared by films. That film is so horrendous.
Horrendous.
I wouldn't recommend anyone seeing it.
Agreed.
Also, both films are really well made, which makes them a lot worse.
Yeah.
Because genuinely scary stuff, you know, is only generally scary when it's done well, I think.
Have you seen Hereditary?
No, I'm a bit, ever since Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I've been a bit scared of horror films.
Yeah, don't see it. So you can be scared still.
I do resist watching scary films on the whole because life is hard enough, isn't it?
Yeah, that's how my mum feels about it, definitely. Mum's like, why would I want to watch that? But do you have any interest in the comedy, the whole thing of comedy and horror are the same?
Well, I get that you get a visceral reaction. And I guess one of the most memorable experiences I had in the cinema the last couple of years was watching Get Out here in LA in a packed cinema. Yeah. And you had the Holy Trinity. You had laughs, yeah, screams, and applause.
Yeah.
Doesn't get a little better than that.
Yeah.
And that obviously is an exceptional film. But yeah, it definitely had the different elements working together really well. It's really hard to pull off those tones in the same movie. But yeah, I know what you mean about horror. You do get a visceral reaction and it is kind of cathartic.
Very rare for comedies to get like good reviews, in the same way it's very rare for horror films to get good reviews.
Yeah, that's probably true.
But the argument that people who make them and people who enjoy them is if you laughed, it worked.
I agree.
And if you jumped, it worked. You know,
yeah, that
it
is true.
Not a failure. Your review is wrong.
Yeah, that Jerry Seinfeld says something similar on his show, and I think that is basically, you could definitely defend that point of view.
Mm. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a really horrible, grubby, horrible film.
Yeah, but it's incredibly well directed, yeah, right? Which is why it's so hard to watch.
And The Omen is Richard Donner, who is on my list of underrated.
It's a really good film, I think. Directors. Great cast. I mean, fucking hell, Gregory Peck,
Come
Amy Remick,
yeah,
Billy Whitelaw.
Come on, in the same film. Yes, please. And I think you made that just after Superman, or just before it.
Yeah, definitely around the same time.
What a lineup.
I think it was like 2 years before, potentially.
God bless him. I was once at a party in Hollywood, sure. And it was in like the hills. I don't know who it was, I don't know what I was doing there. And it turned out they lived next door to Richard Donner. And I wanted to break in. And I got very into this idea that I was going to break into Richard Donner's house. But then I didn't have a plan for what I was going to do when I got there.
Make him show you his cut of Superman 2.
Yeah, yeah. Sit down, put it on, put it on. Anyway, I didn't in the end because I thought it might actually scare him. And it seems there's no way to show your love.
Someone. I think you're probably right.
Yeah, I've really grown. What is the film that made you cry the most? Are you an emotional man?
I do cry at films. They're usually for very specific reasons, like specific scenes that trigger me. I had a very sore knee at one point. I had like a bandage around it. Watched Born on the 4th of July. Cried like a baby.
That's the film you most related to.
I was like, I could so identify with the paraplegic man who was trapped in a wheelchair because I had it was really fucking sore there in my knee. I'm not
bruised.
It was
really bruised.
It was swollen. It was tough. Yeah. It was a tough time. I was on ibuprofen.
You were watching it again. It's sad, mate.
I was sobbing, man.
Yeah.
It's also quite a good film.
But had you not had a sore knee?
I wouldn't have had that reaction. Similar reaction around the same time to Forrest Gump. Calipers got me in the knee.
It's a knee-based tragedy.
Yes.
Is your sweet spot. Okay. Do you cry in your life? Or are you
not a huge amount. Probably not as much as I'd like to. It's very cathartic, the old crying. Mm. But films are a good one. Princess Bride, You Killed My Father, Prepare to Die. And then when he gets there, I mean, I can't even talk about it. I'm feeling quite emotional.
I'm going to have to wrap your knee up. Okay.
That wasn't knee-based. That was more dead dad-based.
Dead dad or a knee. Either or.
Lion King, dead dad. Those are the two main ones, knees and dead fathers.
Don't see stronger. Is that another? Man hurts his knees.
Yeah, I'm going to give that one a miss.
You'll be a wreck. What's a film that no one likes? Critically, people are like, this film's shit. And you're like, you are all idiots. This is the best film ever.
I think probably the one I'd pick for that is a critically unloved movie called Joe versus the Volcano.
Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks.
That's the one.
Jumps in the volcano, gets shot out again.
It's quite a big turkey when it came out.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of love for that film.
So do I. But I haven't seen it since it came out. But I was very young and I was excited about it.
It's not perfect, but it's got some pretty amazing stuff in it. It's very existential, really.
Can you tell me about it?
So it's about a guy who's basically given up on life, mm-hmm. is depressed, and gets a chance to be a hero and sort of evaluate the meaning of life. It's a comedy about the meaning of life, which is what appeals to me, I think.
Yeah, that's your thing.
And it doesn't shy away from it. And Meg Ryan plays three parts.
Yes.
Which she does very well, because she's kind of amazing.
What is the end of it, other than him jumping in a volcano and getting shut out again?
They float off on a raft together.
Is the meaning of life love each other?
Yeah, love is definitely a big part of it. Some really funny bits in it.
Wow. Okay. What is a film that you used to love, but you've watched it recently and you've gone, oh dear?
I think that would probably be The Birds, the Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, why?
Well, I did really love it when I first saw it, and I watched it again, and the special effects are so not great.
Yeah.
Particularly the climactic scene where they're all being attacked by birds in the house.
Yeah.
Which, if you look at it not very carefully, it's quite obvious that it's two things that are happening. One is that a lot of actors have some toy birds stuck to their wigs.
Yeah.
And they're fighting with the toy birds stitched to their clothes and hair.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's happening is that there's a screen of flying birds put over the scene of the actors with the birds attached to their clothes. And when I saw that, I was like, I can't watch this anymore.
But also, within that scene, Alfred Hitchcock is lobbing birds at her head. Yes.
Also that.
Just by camera.
There's a lot going on that's not great, particularly at the ending. But some of it is amazing. And the fact that it's got no music in it was a big revelation to me.
Yeah.
Because the soundtrack, or lack of one, is a really big part of the film.
And it's a horrible, no explanation, no happy ending.
Yeah, I mean, it is great, but it's also unwatchable.
What is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily because the film is any good, but because the story you associate with the film, it will always mean something to you. So it might have been the first date you went on, might have been the day you got a job, might have been the day someone died. Could be anything, but you'll always remember that film for this reason.
Yeah, it's a good question, that.
Thank you. It's my favourite.
I don't want to sound like unromantic, but I think the story that sprung to mind when I was thinking about that was actually going to see a film on my own.
Lovely.
Before Sunrise. I went to see Before Sunrise at the NFT, now the BFI South Bank.
Yes.
And the friend I was going to go with didn't turn up, so it's just me on my own. And I love that film. It's one of my favourites. Never seen it before, obviously. Just come out. And I remember walking home, getting the train home, and just being kind of like subsumed with the movie, and also feeling that sort of connection between me and the film and the director, and feeling actually, you know, that connection was something really profound. Just I could just almost sit with the film and not have to talk about it immediately afterwards. It almost like I was in the film for the whole journey home. And that kind of communion, for want of a better word, stayed with me as like one of the things you can get from a film which you can't get from a lot of other experiences. And I've absolutely love watching films of my own. Like, I love watching them with my wife and friends, but I also really enjoy watching them on my own for that reason.
Yeah, I'd rather watch alone, always. It's like church.
Yeah.
Is it not? It's the thing of, I think it's Alan Bennett's, has a quote which is like, that good art or something is like, if you read a book from 200 years ago and you connect to it, it's like a hand reaching across time and taking yours. Like, that is that thing that you're connected through this magic.
It is really special. And that's, I guess, what keeps me excited about trying to do it, is making that connection with people that you'll never meet, just on a kind of intimate but very, you know, broad way. It's a kind of intoxicating combination.
Have you ever done stand-up or performed or anything? No performing of any kind?
Not at all, no.
Yeah, because you then don't get the hit, I suppose, even though, even when you've made Peep Show, I'm guessing you're not watching it with an audience.
No, though we did do screening parties every series, but no, you're not watching it with the audience. Doing my play last 2017 was my experience of that, which was kind of amazing. But no, I don't really get that hit of performing ever.
So now you have Twitter, so at least you occasionally get a message.
Yeah, which is actually great. Mm. I think it's great for writers, Twitter, because people don't really tweet you unless they've bothered to find out who you are, and they wouldn't bother unless they appreciated all your work. So I don't really get much hate. It's all pretty much positive.
That's very interesting. So you, when you put something out, you don't get the hit, but you sort of have the belief, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Go and enjoy it.
You have to sort of try and believe that it might connect to people, yeah.
Magic. Right. What's the film that you're most related to, other than Born on the 4th of July?
Probably that. My Dinner with Andre.
My Dinner with Andre. Can I say what posters you have on your wall?
Sure.
So I'm in Sam's study.
Yeah, office study.
Office study. And he's got six film posters. Rushmore, My Dinner with Andre, Four Lions, Yes Please, Husbands and Wives, Grey Gardens, and Eight and a Half. I mean, it's a good lineup. It's a pretty good fucking lineup, isn't it? That's a night out. That's a proper night out. My Dinner with Andre is the film you relate to most. Yes!
You've seen it?
I have seen it.
I'm sure you loved it.
I do actually love it.
Of course you do, because you're a seeker.
Yeah, go on. I am a seeker, yes. But I've never heard it before. Why am I a seeker?
You just are.
Yeah. Okay.
You want to get to the grips with the depths of the world and life.
Yeah.
And that's what they do in that film.
My Dinner with Andre is a man seeking. It is good. Do you know what? I've seen it once, and weirdly, I remember it so well. It stayed with me for many, many years, and I think I almost watched it because you think it's a joke. You think, surely it's not.
Yeah.
Just a dinner
with
Andre.
Yeah, when I told people, friends of mine, to watch it, they're like, so what is it? It's two people having dinner for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Right.
And then a killer comes in? No.
Does anything happen? Well, a waiter brings some potato soup in at one point. That's a highlight.
Do they enjoy the meal? Yeah, meal's fine. Okay.
It's like an anti-film. It also happens to be a brilliant film.
Mm.
And if you haven't seen it, there's a lot of long speeches. It's quite theatrical. It's almost like watching a play. And what's really amazing is that it's a bit like the marriage of literature and film, because like in one of his long monologues, Andre Gregory, it's semi-autobiographical, you really start to visualise what he's saying in the way that you never normally do when you're watching a film, because normally you're looking at the images, you don't have to visualise anything.
Yeah.
It's like reading a book and watching a film at the same time. Just doesn't sound maybe great, but I thought it was pretty amazing.
It's very funny, the poster, which I've never seen before, is Andre and Inconceivable from Princess Bride looking at each other, and it's four times, it's them looking at each other times four, and they basically look the same. It's a very subtle difference, which is sort of, that is a visual representation of the film. It's just two men looking at each other having a chat.
Yeah.
For 2 hours.
Which is probably what Peep Show is a bit like, but not quite so much about doing theatre in the Polish forests.
Yes. Yeah, Peep Show has more jokes. But Peep Show is very existential, isn't it?
Well, probably, certainly the format is, you're kind of driving a drill in someone's brain.
But it's also the, I suppose, like, Waiting for Godot. It's sort of I liked that that they were never going to evolve. That it ended, they were never going to leave each other.
But that's the joy of sitcom.
Yeah.
Steptoe and all the great sitcoms have that stasis, which I think you have to really embrace.
Was it hard when you did your final episode? That's difficult to do your last one, is it?
We definitely had a strong idea of what we didn't want to do, which was like a kind of a final episode. We wanted to do a sort of normal episode, which happened to end the series. We didn't want to kind of stop the clocks and just do something different. We did, for one draft, I think we had a sort of, it ended with a party, and we did have a draft where there were lots of characters from old series turning up, but we sort of thought that would really slow everything down and be a distraction, so we kind of had to kill our darlings on that one. But yeah, it was bittersweet, to say the least.
Yeah, because it was what, 9 years, 10 years?
Nine years. Series over 12 years.
That is a big part of your life.
Mm.
Did you have a cry when it ended?
I cried during the editing.
Did you?
But not at the party. I think Dave and Robert might have wept a little bit. Don't know about Jesse. If he did, he probably went off to the toilet to do it in private, as crying should always be done.
Yeah, good man. Correct. Glad to hear it, Jesse. Correct.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49%. Based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global. Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What is... I love Grey Gardens. What is... here we go. Have you answered the related to... Oh yeah, my dinner with Andre. So you are the Princess Bride geezer.
No, I'm both. You're both. Man. That's the thing.
You are both.
That's the great thing about drama. You can be both. You'd have to pick.
You're the seeker and the...
And the guy's like, look, just have an electric blanket and just have a nice time. Why run around the earth looking for the meaning of life? It's right here and with your girlfriend having a cup of cold coffee in the morning.
Ah, I love it. Speak it. Right, here we go. What? Right, hold my eye contact for this. Hold it. What's the sexiest film of all time? You may look away.
The sexiest film ever.
For you.
I don't know about the whole film, but the opening scene of Betty Blue is pretty sexy. Maybe not the bit when she... Does she gouge her eye out?
Has her eyes out, yeah.
Maybe not that bit.
Okay, you can have that caveat. Betty Blue for 7 minutes and then eject the VHS.
Yeah.
That is an extraordinary opening scene.
It is.
If you've never seen it, it is two people having sex. For a very long time, in one take, one shot. Very believable, very sexy, really good. I mean, really good sex, actually. Good luck to them both. And then it says, I met Betty when the weather changed, or something like that.
That sounds about right.
When it's the storm came. And then it goes, and then you have you're off.
Mm.
Great scene.
Yeah.
Very lovely stuff.
Two beautiful naked French people having sex. Yeah. What's not to like?
What is not to like? And there's something about that sort of French cinema where it doesn't feel... You go, yeah, nudity is fine, isn't it? It's not a thing we should worry about, in a way that I found with many other films. I go, this scene's gratuitous. Is everyone okay? What's going on? Should we worry about this? But with something like Betty Blue, you go, yeah, no, it's cool.
It seems that way.
Yeah.
It was a good age for it. I was like, it's probably 18 when it came out, 19. It's a good age for that.
Good age for Betty Blue. That's a lovely age for baby. Now, what's the film? Now, if it's a subcategory, the subcategory is troubling boners, worrying wydons.
Well, I've got a specific answer to that, which is Basic Instinct. And the reason being is because for a while last year, Sharon Stone was attached to star in the film me and Patrick made. So I watched that. I watched Casino and Basic Instinct again to sort of catch up on how great she was, and she is great in both those films. But I met her the following day, and that I found quite strange.
Yeah.
Like, hi, nice to meet you. I just saw you probably naked, or maybe it was a body double having sex with Michael Douglas, or maybe it was not you. Yeah. But anyway, I'm looking at you and thinking about that.
Yes, that is a very good answer. How did you cope?
I just tried to forget I'd seen it, but she was super nice. We had some lovely chats with her at her house.
Yeah.
That was a good experience.
She's cool. You say? I've not met her.
Yeah, she was. Is.
Good. Basic Instinct 2, one of my favourites.
David Morrissey.
Yeah, David Morrissey.
I haven't seen that one.
It's a good time. I mean, it's odd. Sure. I think it opens with Stan Collymore.
Oh, yeah, he's in it.
She sort of kills him in a car.
As every film should open.
Yeah. It's also weirdly, like, doesn't sort of have any sex in it.
Okay.
But sort of feels like it does.
Feels like it might.
Yeah. There's the threat of sex the whole time. And she's become like she's like a horror sex killer.
Mm-hmm.
It's all very, it loses the, you know, wonderful three-dimensional feel that Basic Instinct 1 had.
There was a lot of sex in films in the 80s and 90s, even like mainstream comedies. They'd have a topless scene.
Always a random topless scene.
And I think that was probably the whole pre-internet era when people might have bought a ticket on the hope they might see some tits, which doesn't really happen anymore.
I think it was for the VHSs.
Yeah.
It was say, come see the film, see them, have a laugh, and then buy it at home for, you know what I mean? And then the internet happened, and we're like, oh, we don't need to bother. Put your clothes on. The internet's happened. We could just do comedy now. Interesting. What is the, objectively, the greatest film of all time?
Well, obviously, objectively is ridiculous, but I'll say The Godfather.
Okay.
I can't think of a more perfect film.
Singing in the Rain. Have you heard of Singing in the Rain?
Okay, to be fair, Godfather doesn't have that many great dance sequences.
No.
And it would definitely be improved if it had a few.
Yeah.
Just like Michael doing a tap dance on his enemy's grave.
Oh, imagine it. No, that's got more rewatch value. okay, Godfather. You know, I think Nish Kumar and Ricky Gervais also picked The Godfather.
Well, I'm in good company then.
So you're in very good company there. You can have it.
I don't feel you're really feeling it for The Godfather.
It's not my objective greatest film of all time, but I still respect you, I guess. It's definitely good. It's good.
Thank you.
The Good Father. what's the film you could watch or have watched the most over and over again?
Probably Taxi Driver.
Really?
I'm a big fan of that.
I love Taxi Driver.
I saw it in a way that was kind of both perfect and totally wrong, which was that I was about probably 12.
Yeah.
And someone showed it at film club at my school. And it's obviously an X certificate film. But it really made a big impression on me. And it kind of got me, it's probably the film that really got me thinking about films more than anything else at that age. And it's, yeah, I just think it's a masterpiece. It's got kind of everything, the score, the performances, the script is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's just got a very unique feel about it.
Two things I love about it. Well, many things, but one of them is I love the, and I always think about it as a choice, a directing choice, when he's on the phone making a very awful, kind of humiliating phone call with the girl and the camera moves away to the corridor, sort of leaves him alone, like, this is too much.
That's a great, we can't, you're right, it's this. A great shot, that. It always stayed with me, the idea that you would rather look at an empty corridor than this phone call. And what's wonderful about that is it doesn't really have an obvious meaning behind it. Like, it's not making an obvious point. It's like poetry, really, because it's not clear what that camera track is for, other than to...
It's to spare him, I think. It's because it's too... It's so kind of humiliating and sort of sad that we... The camera's sort of going, let's leave, we shouldn't watch this.
That's a very good interpretation. Or you could say, this is a man who is so marginal that he's out of shot in his own film.
That's funny. That's a funny way of looking at it. I always remember, and this may mean nothing to anyone... ER, I used to watch ER, I loved ER. I watched every episode, I thought it was brilliant. And there was one episode of ER that had, at the end of it, there was a boy who was like on his way to prom and there was a car crash and he was going to die. And he's in the hospital bed and he's literally got, they've sort of, whatever it is, he's got like an hour and he's going to die. And his parents are too far away. And there's they did this thing and they did it all in one take where they just kept the camera in the room. And they have the nurse bring a phone to the boy, and the boy is speaking to his parents. and it's the last time he's going to speak to him and he's going to die. And the camera just held on it, and it's quite a long, it was like a 5-minute sequence. And I remember being very, like, upset by it and sort of thinking, this is cruel. Like, we shouldn't be, like, it was obviously very well done and it was very powerful, but I felt like we shouldn't be here and we shouldn't just be locked on it. It's like the opposite of the Taxi Driver moment. It felt too intimate or too like, we shouldn't be watching. This is so, such a private, horrible moment. I don't want to be here. And the camera didn't move. It's interesting, isn't it?
But, well, yeah, that's really, it's an interesting reaction. It's almost like the essence of cinema and TV is voyeurism, isn't it?
Yeah.
You are, it's what Hitchcock knew so well and did so well in films like Psycho, where you are taking the place as a voyeur watching. Because what you do when you watch a film, you're sort of pretending to be this fly on the wall.
Yeah.
Eavesdropping, basically, on all these people and trying to figure out what they're thinking. And you're just being a big, big old nosy Parker.
Yeah. Because Hitchcock was definitely like, liked you being a pervert, didn't he? He's like, come on, let's have a look over here.
Well, Psycho, I think, was my favourite of his because of that, I think, which a bit like Travis Bickle, you got a real anti-hero, obviously, in Norman Bates. Mm. But what's so shockingly brilliant about that movie is the way that he forces you to empathise with him.
Yeah.
Because when he kills Janet Leigh, the audience is, you can't watch a film and not empathise with someone. Because if you stopped empathising, you would just not watch it.
Yes.
You know, cinema is a machine to create empathy.
Yeah.
So you're forced, quite literally, to move your empathy from her to him. Yeah. And then you're kind of, the rug is pulled out from you. You're almost realise that you've been sold the wrong person. And that is a really stunning trick.
Mm.
And it stayed with me because empathy is the key to everything, I think, in films.
Yes.
And trying to find out how you create it, because it's not easy to create it. You know, a lot of people find films boring. They don't care about what's happening. And it's all an illusion, isn't it? You're creating this illusion of empathy with unreal people.
How do you think there's a key to it?
I do. I think probably casting, I don't want to give actors too much power because, you know, they don't deserve it.
Yeah.
But
agreed.
Casting a good actor who's sympathetic is a huge deal.
Mm.
A good example in my career is Four Lions, because I was always really, really worried that we wouldn't sympathise with the lead character, Omar, in that, because obviously he's a terrorist, for one thing.
Yeah.
But then you cast someone like Riz Ahmed, which who Chris cast, and a lot of those problems just drifted away because he's so compelling and good-looking. Doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
You know, cinema beauty almost counts for half of empathy a lot of times because you're just compelled by that person. And I'm not saying the script wasn't, you know, part of it, but casting him was a huge part of it, I think.
Wow. That's very interesting. Because I sort of, you must have come across this a lot. I've had script notes with people going, this character's not likeable, or your lead character's like too mean or too whatever. And I always fight it. A, because I go, there's a million examples of very successful things where the characters aren't nice people.
Mm.
And B, because I think that generally, whoever the lead is, we automatically go, oh, that's our guy, even if they're a terrible person. Because I think that's always been my theory on how we watch stuff. So with Norman Bates, you go, okay, well, he's the lead now. I guess we're with him. And I saw that film Filth, which I really enjoyed. And it was like a real sort of good experiment for this, because in the first 5 minutes, he does terrible, genuinely abhorrent stuff. And I found myself thinking, yeah, I'm still with him. You know what I mean? Because he's the lead.
Of course I'm still with him.
It's James McAvoy, and he's the lead of the story. So
I wish I agreed with you that the lead always creates sympathy, but I don't think it's quite that easy. I think you need to have good writing, good acting to do that. I think if it's someone else other than McAvoy, and there could be 100 actors who could play that part, but a lot of them would not be appealing.
Yeah, well, you may be right. Actually, thinking about it, I saw a play the other day, and I would definitely not name it, and the lead actor was sort of technically very good, everything was fine, but I was like, you are inherently unlikable as a person. I don't like you. You're right. Fuck.
But the other thing, like another example which is probably relevant is Peep Show, because with Jeremy, we were always worried that he wasn't as likeable because he's not as sympathetic. He's more of a narcissist, more selfish. And one thing that we did from sort of series two onwards in particular was really make him suffer a lot.
Right.
Particularly having his heart broken by various beautiful women.
Yeah.
Which seemed to work because I think when someone's suffering, it's a really, really easy way to get on side because, you know, you relate your own experience of suffering with that and that's a release, it's a relief. Yeah. And that's pretty foolproof. If someone's not suffering, I think it's hard to empathise.
That's why I hate Entourage.
There you go.
My theory does not hold up, and you've solved it. It's casting and suffering.
Not enough pain.
Yeah, Entourage, they're all just having a lovely time, and
having
I hate
a great time.
I hate them. Hate them all.
There you go.
Can we talk briefly about Four Lions?
Sure.
I think Four Lions is one of the greatest films ever made.
Wow, thank you.
I would rank it with Life of Brian. I think it is as important and as funny and as clever and as meaningful as Life of Brian. I think those two are the best satire films ever made. There, I said it.
Wow.
Tell me about, right, was it scary? Because people forget, because now everyone knows it's amazing, that in the build-up it was like, what on earth are they doing? This is, let's kill them all.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. I mean, I have to give, you know, almost all the credit to Chris because it was his concept and he shepherded it for years through all the obstacles. But yeah, he came to me and Jesse with like some characters and an idea of a sort of general structure. But what was interesting was that he didn't really have, Chris is very unusual in the sense he doesn't say, right, I'm going to want to make this film and let's do it by November or whatever. It was like, I don't know if this is going to work.
Right.
But if it did happen, how might it work? It was almost like a thought experiment.
Great.
You know, he's got the freedom to just experiment, and there was not really...
So
like,
there could have been a version, but it just never happened. Well, we tried it, it doesn't work.
Definitely. There was a point, because we talked about it for months before we really wrote anything, and there was definitely a point during those months where, yeah, okay, we tried, didn't work, do something else.
Yeah.
You know, because it was like almost a thing of if you had to write a comedy about suicide bombers, what would you do? How could you do that? It was like, almost like a question, asking comedy a question.
Yeah.
And that film was our answer. And I think there are a couple of moments I remember where it felt like it was clicking when we all came up with the set piece of the marathon at the end with the funny costumes. That was a bit we all felt excited about because it was like, well, that's definitely funny.
Yeah.
And physical comedy is almost like your most reliable, it's almost like your star player in a football team. It's going to score your goals for you. Physical comedy, people love it. It's just very reliable. If you can get something that works, it's what everyone remembers. I mean, whenever I see those best 10 best picture episode lists, which have appeared over the years, 9 of them are normally physical comedy jokes. Yeah, or like Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah.
You know, it's those that work bits people quote because it just goes in on some level that's really deep and satisfying. So anyway, coming up with the costumes and all that felt like, yeah, that's a tone which is silly but also quite serious, and that feels like that might work. Maybe this will work.
Mm.
That was a turning point day, I think.
I think it's sort of, I'm going to say it to you, I think it's a genuinely profound film because I think it takes a thing that we are scared of, we're terrified of, and humanizes it and sort of takes some of the power out of it by bringing it to a sort of, I compared it to like the opening scene of Four Lions with the video, and then he says, you're going to look small. Like the reality of, or part of it is just going into the, what is this like in real world then? These things that scare us, these images, these things, and breaking it down to the mundane. And it is the same as like the Sermon on the Mount in Life of Brian, them going, I can't hear, what's he saying? Like just looking at, what's that actually like? Well, actually, most people couldn't fucking hear it.
Yeah.
That's funny. And also now we're in, okay, now we're grounded. You know what I mean? Love it.
Yeah, I'll take that. That's very generous comparison. I'm a big fan of Life of Brian. Yeah, and I think that was Chris's genius to actually want to have a good, hard look with his comedy genius at the reality of what those people might be like. And that was a really fun adventure to go on with him.
Yeah. Well done.
Thank you.
what's the... Oh, yeah, because we were on Taxi Driver. Oh, I said there was two things I liked about it. The corridor, that's where we went to. Oh, and the other thing was... Oh, I think Taxi Driver is really funny.
Yes.
Really funny. Underrated as a comedy. Funny, yeah. There's a really funny bit where he's being sold guns by a sleazy guy.
Yeah.
He's in the room and the guy goes, you want some drugs as well? And he goes like, fuck you, as if like, what do you think I am, weird? What do you think I am, disgusting? And he's buying the guy, it's funny. And the ending, what is your feeling on the epilogue of Taxi Driver?
Well, it's a bit ambiguous. I'm not sure really what exactly is going on. I think he becomes sort of a folk hero, doesn't he? Or somehow gets off, which I don't really believe, but
is it
fine.
Is it a dream?
Maybe. Endings are hard, whatever. It's a good film.
Your take is, man, listen, Scorsese, endings are hard, man. Good effort.
They just are. I mean, Ibsen ends most of his plays with suicide. Even he can come up with good endings. Oh, I'll just get them to kill themselves. Next play.
Ibsen, sorry, I've just read back your play. They kill themselves in this one as well. Yeah, it will do.
It's a good ending.
It worked before.
It works. It's dramatic. Definitely. It's, everyone knows when to leave.
Yeah. People in the audience, for big fans of his, going, when's someone going to fucking kill themselves? This is
the guy selling guns and Taxi Driver. Scorsese made a whole documentary about him.
Really?
Called American Boy, which I've never seen. It's quite hard to get a hold of. But he's like, he's sort of playing himself, I think.
Ooh. Interesting.
That. So track that down.
Okay. Do you know the story that a man broke into Paul Schrader's office after Taxi Driver came out and held him at gunpoint and said, how do you know about my life?
I have heard that. I've forgotten. But yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah. It's a bit disturbing, but yeah. Imagine that. You must get a lot of people from Peep Show not breaking in with guns, but saying, how do you know about my life?
Not really, but... You know, it's amazing how long that show's lifespan is. People still tweet me about it all the time.
Have you done anything before that?
Nothing of any great quality.
Right. But you'd always wanted to be a writer?
Well, I guess I wanted to be a film director in a way that you do when you're 14. Yeah. And then I didn't really know how that was going to happen. I started writing at university. Me and Jesse met on a creative writing course.
Yeah.
We were about 19. That's when I started properly writing.
Okay. And you fell in love then?
Yeah, I thought, I want to do this.
He's been slowly poisoning you ever since.
And he's been slowly poisoning me ever since.
What's the worst film ever made? Don't like to be negative, so we'll do it quick. What's the worst film ever made?
Well, I don't know. Again, objectively, obviously we cannot say due to the fact that there is no such thing. But my personal worst experience is probably watching The Godfather Part 3. Due to the fact that I loved the first two so much.
Yeah.
And I was alive and kicking in 1990 when the third one came out. And I was 19 and I went to the cinema on the opening night expecting it to be as good, if not better, than the first two. And it is not a good film. But, you know, it's all about expectations. Mm. If I'd watched it maybe in isolation, I wouldn't have hated it so much. But I was so disappointed.
It's the Scream 3 of Godfather films, isn't it?
It's just not a good film.
Mm.
I mean, there's a scene where, you know, Michael Corleone and Kay, Diane Keaton's character, have a sort of cheerful exes catch up over a coffee or whatever. And it's like, but the last film, you were screaming that you aborted a child so he wouldn't grow up to be like him, and now you're just having a coffee. What?
Did you watch these films back before you made this one? Yeah. Shame. What's the funniest film? What's the film that made you laugh the most?
I've got a few answers to that. Is that all right?
You can have a few and we'll then have to pick one.
I'm a sort of child of the 80s, comedy-wise, so all three of my picks are 80s movies. Airplane.
Great.
The Man with Two Brains.
Ah, yes!
And Spinal Tap.
Oh!
Probably my laugh-out-loud movies.
That's a good list. I'm gonna take Man with Two Brains because
yeah, I'll probably
the
take
other
that.
Two have come up a lot.
And to be fair on that film, it's not by any means a perfect movie, but I say the first half an hour in particular has more amazing jokes than almost any other film ever made.
Yeah,
it goes off a little bit towards around the middle and the end. There's a lot of very dated electronic score and some tits, obviously.
Love the score. Yeah, weird surgery tits. Yes. Weird tits and surgery to keep them. Cover that. I'm a man, flesh and blood.
and a hooker who flashes her tits in a way that you wouldn't probably do when it wasn't 1982. But it's a
It's a good joke. In fairness, that's a good joke.
It's a very funny film, and he is unbelievably brilliant in it, obviously, because he's a comic genius.
I think that's my dad's favourite. I fucking love Man with Two Brains. It is funny. And there's a scene in it, and maybe with your seeking, there's a scene in Man with Two Brains where he's talking to a painting of his dead wife.
Yeah.
And he says, show me a sign if I'm making the wrong decision.
Just any sign.
Any sign.
I'll be looking out for it.
And the painting starts spinning. You hear screaming, no! The lights flash. Everything explodes. And then it stops and he goes, just any sign.
Any kind of sign, I'll be looking out for it. In the meantime, I'll put you in the basement. Takes the painting off the wall.
So good.
Yeah, I mean, also, there's a lot of sustained sexual frustration in the first half of the film, which is inherently funny and brilliantly delivered.
That's true.
Including the scene where he breaks the window with his erection, which I was 11 when that came out, and that's pretty much the perfect age for that joke. Mm. Although it's still a great joke at age 47.
Good age for that joke. I also love, my other favourite bit is he says to his wife, our marriage lies broken and shattered like this vase, and he throws it at the floor and it bounces straight up and he goes, Indian rubber vase, eh?
Yeah.
Fuck, it's a good film.
It's really good and underrated, really, I think.
Yeah.
We can say. Can we say that?
I think so, because people don't mention it enough.
Well, let's keep mentioning it.
Yeah, Man with Two Brains. Fuck, it's good. All right, well done. 10 points. 20 points for that.
Great.
You're in the lead.
Thanks.
Now, Sam Bain, you've been excellent. However, when Jesse Armstrong slowly poisoned you over 2 weeks, you thought you had a bit of flu, and he came around to write you anything, but he weirdly kept bringing contracts over. And while he was sleepy, you kept signing them, but it seemed fine. For your new project, he said it was for, you were often signing over the rights to all the things you'd ever done, including Four Lions and all the Peep Show and Corporate Animals, which you didn't write. Apparently now his name's on it. Anyway, when you died from the poison, Mercury, when we found you, because you didn't tell anyone for ages. And when we found you, the mercury had expanded inside of you and your body was fucking massive.
Right.
It was a very weird...
It's what that does, mercury expands.
Yeah, in heat,
yeah,
as we know. So your whole body had become...
I'm like a big thermometer.
You're a giant thermometer. And we saw first, that's why no one found you for a long time as well, because you were just silver. It was like, what's this fucking silver... statue in that bed, in Jesse Armstrong's bed. Anyway, we found you, got your body. We stuffed it in this coffin, but it was shattered, some of the mercury. Anyway, get you in this coffin. There was a lot more of you than we'd planned for. We'd bought a coffin that was your size, not one that was five times the size of you, which is what you'd grown to. So we stuffed you into this coffin. There's no room in there. There's only room for one DVD that we can slip in the side. And when you go to the other side, you take that with you, and there's movie night every night. One movie night is your movie night. What film are you showing to everyone in heaven?
Can I have a Blu-ray? It's a DVD.
It has to be a DVD, I'm afraid. Did they have a Blu-ray out there? It's weird. But it's excellent. It's in excellent condition.
4K?
No, just a straight DVD. Couple of special features, sure.
So heaven was really finished in the 80s.
Yeah. But not technically, but the seats. Oh, the seats.
I'd probably take the Taxi Driver.
He's taking Taxi Driver.
It's a great movie.
Cheering
it's
everyone
funny
up.
Than you remember. If not that, then...
That's your intro.
Yeah.
Listen, guys, I know this sounds depressing, but it's funnier than you remember. Cheers.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, you can have that.
Either that or The Princess Bride. Everyone likes that film.
No, I mean, I'm sure that's already up there.
Double Bill.
What a
double classic Double Which Bill. Order? Taxi Driver first.
Yeah, Princess Bride. Pick yourself off the floor. Okay. Sam Bain, now, before we finish, is there anything you would like to tell the people at home or at the gym or in their car, wherever they are, or on the tube? They could be anywhere. Hot air balloon. It's up to you.
Just like my final words.
Yeah. Or look out for Corporate Animals.
My manifesto. Keep watching films, guys. Films are great.
Also, particularly watch Corporate Animals.
Corporate Animals coming out to your cinemas soon, hopefully.
And The Stand-In.
And The Stand-In.
And imagine it was a man in the lead.
Don't. It's all over. That's ancient history.
And keep watching Peep Show
Why not? If you've got nothing better to do, watch Peep Show.
And you know what? When you enjoy something with Sam, send him a nice tweet. Nice for him to get some feedback, as long as it's positive. If it's not positive, please don't.
Just tweet Brett.
Send me it and I'll filter it. Okay. Thank you very much for your time. I hope you have a lovely time on the other side. Good day to you, sir. So that was episode 63. Join the Patreon for extra content at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. And if you do enjoy the show, please subscribe and give it 5 stars. And instead of giving a review, tell me the film that meant the most to you and why. Put that in where you would write a review. People have started doing that and it's so nice to read. Even if you don't want to leave a review, go and have a look what people have been writing. It's fucking great. And if you do that, it helps people hear the podcast more. It changes something. Or numbers, who cares? Just do it. It's a nice thing to do and we can all live our lives. Thank you so much to Sam Bain. Please go see his film Corporate Animals at the cinema. Yes, on the big screen. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distracting Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Agus for hosting it. To Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come join me next week where my special guest is one of my personal favourites. It is the brilliant comedian and filmmaker and actor and writer, Melissa Stevens. But in the meantime, have a lovely week and please be excellent to each other.
Diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.